Today we're going to be discussing the religious and cultural background of Christianity, in particular with regard to the Jewish world. Religious ideas, even those that in retrospect, you know, seem to have been revolutionary in some way, do not emerge in a vacuum. That isn't the case now, and it wasn't the case in the ancient world. Okay? They are responses to conditions that existed at the time that it arose. Right? And they are articulated in a language familiar to contemporaries, so they would understand them. And we have to think of Christianity the same way. When Jesus first started his mission, he didn't come as the founder of a new religion, but he was a Jew. Okay, he followed Jewish ways. He had Jewish beliefs. All of his early followers were Jewish. And they, in turn, had been influenced by the culture around them, the Greco-Roman culture. So, and then, as we trace Christianity, we're going to find as it expands, it's going to become more and more influenced by the Greco-Roman world. So we're going to talk about all of these environments and the dominant cultural ethos, because those things affect the growth and the emergence of Christianity. All right? We'll do Greco-Roman culture a little bit later in the class. But now we're going to discuss the Jewish religious and cultural background, because it'll help us to understand Christianity better. Okay? All right. So first, a little history about the political situation in this part of the world at the time, or just we'll start just before the time of Jesus. Okay? All right. So how did it come to be that the land of Judea became ruled by the Romans? Some of you may know a little bit of this, but let me just back up a little bit. Judea was ruled by a Jewish dynasty, the Hasmoneans, called the Hasmonean dynasty, for almost 100 years leading up to this time period. They had been under the rule of the Seleucid Empire, but nothing you need to worry about right now. Okay? But then they gradually gained independence near the end. There came a point where there were two of these Hasmonean brothers. I think I'm just going to leave out their names. But anyway, they fought for the possession of the throne. One of them was high priest already at the temple at Jerusalem, and he wanted to be king too. And the other brother's like, hey, you get to be high priest, why can't I be king then? You know. So they started a civil war. All right, I'm very much simplifying this. But anyway, they got into a civil war. One of them goes to the Romans for assistance. And who does he approach but none other than the famous Roman general Pompey, who was in the area. He was up in the north fighting some other Roman enemies up there. And the one brother says, hey, can you help me out and defeat my other brother? And Pompey did. Okay. But when all is said and done, Pompey decided that he really didn't even want the first brother to rule the kingdom either. So he decided, because he had the power, that Rome was going to take control of the area, but they would put in a puppet king, you know, a vassal king. You know what a vassal is? That's a ruler who rules under somebody else. Okay, a client king. All right. So Pompey puts in his own king over the whole land. And he's ruling there, of course, on behalf of the Romans. He's supposed to, you know, give the Romans tribute, and he gets protection, and so on and so forth. But it's semi-independent. It's not a Roman province or anything. The treaty that they signed allowed the Jews in Judea to continue with their customs, and they could worship however they wanted, as long as the Jewish priests sacrificed daily at Jerusalem, on behalf of the leaders of Rome. It's kind of like a sign of allegiance. So the Romans even agreed to pay for the sacrificial animals. So it was agreed to do that. Now they fitted into their own, you know, ritual customs there, and tried to do it in such a way that they didn't think it would violate their monotheistic principles. Okay. And so, from that point on, there will be sacrifices made at the temple on behalf of the Romans who were ruling over them. Okay, So that happened in 63 BCE. Oh, and I probably should mention this. You might wonder, hey, we're doing a class on Christianity and he's not using BC and he's using BCE instead. What's up with that? Does anyone know what BCE means? Before the Common Era, right. And it's the same thing as BC as far as the numbers are concerned. And CE, Common Era, is the same as AD as far as the numbers are concerned. All right. I'm using them because, well, it's the historical convention. Okay, scholars do this because there are scholars from all different religions who study all these things, and they like to use something that they all can agree on that's neutral. But there's another reason why I'm using it. When the number system was invented, let's say we got a timeline here. I'm going off on a tangent, but anyway. When they invented this system, which was centuries later, they said, all right, this is the year that Jesus was born. They did this in Western Europe, you know, because it was mainly a Christian area. They say, okay, this will be the year that Jesus was born. We will call it, do you know what they called it? You'd think zero. Yeah, but it ain't zero. You ever see, like, in Back to the Future when he's like, we'll go back to the birth of Christ, December 25th, 0000. That's not only wrong at the year, it's wrong with the date, too. But anyway, there is no zero year. No, it's 1 AD. Okay? Anno Domini, which means in the year of our Lord. Okay? The first year of our Lord, the second year of our Lord, the third year of our Lord. They're ordinal numbers, first, second, third. Okay? And then you have 1 year before Christ, 2 years before Christ, and three, and so on. That's how it was worked. But they got the year wrong. Okay? Jesus was not born in 1 AD. Now, to be sure, we're not exactly sure when he was born, but we are pretty certain that he wasn't born in 1 AD. The most common dates you'll hear are like 2 BC or 4 BC or even 6 BC. Sometimes you'll hear 6 AD. So, I mean, how could Christ be born 2 years before Christ? Right? So it doesn't exactly work. That's another reason why I use BCE. Okay? But the numbers are still the same. Okay, so now we got that straightened away. I want to tell you about Herod the Great. Remember, Pompey put in a king. All right? This king, by the way, was not Jewish. He lived nearby. He was from Idumea, which is south of Judea, but it's part of the area. Okay? So he put in this foreigner guy. You know? He wasn't that well liked, but anyway, he had a son. He had a wife who was Jewish, and then they had a son. He was half Jewish, half Idumean. That's Herod the Great. So he's the next king. It's a dynasty, right? It's this dynasty of kings. And Herod will go on to become great, and I'll tell you why in a second. All right, so anyway, Herod came to start ruling the area about 37 BCE, okay? And he ruled until about 4 BCE. Herod did a couple of important things. He really tried hard to please the people in the land, and he did a lot to help the land to prosper. He built a great port, Caesarea, which brought in a lot of trade, and the economy improved. Probably most significantly for the Jews, as far as their religion was concerned, he completely refurbished the temple in Jerusalem, expanded it, made it magnificent. I mean, the one that they had there was a cheap copy of the original temple that Solomon had built, but he really made it impressive. And everyone now wants to go and visit it. It became a big tourist attraction. But he was known for that, and it took many years to do this. But he also built a great fortress not too far from Jerusalem called Masada. Have you ever heard of Masada? I'll talk about it again. M-A-S-A-D-A. Almost impregnable, okay, on a plateau. But he did a lot for the territory. Another little trivia point about Herod the Great is that he's mentioned in one of the New Testament works, the Gospel of Matthew. He's in the birth story of Jesus in that gospel as the evil king who wants to kill all the babies. Do you know the story from the Christmas story or whatever? Yeah, in the story, Jesus is just born. Herod the Great finds out what, there's another king who's going to try and take my place, you know, and I want to kill all the babies. I think it actually says from 2 years and under to make sure that this king of the Jews doesn't survive. And then he isn't able to do it. We have no extra biblical support for that event, but that's the Herod that it's talking about, this guy. Okay? I should mention this, that even though he renovated the Jerusalem temple, he did also help build a number of pagan temples, you know, non-Jewish temples in his territory. So he did a little bit for everybody. He also had ruled very heavy-handedly, and it is said that he anyone that opposed him, he did get rid of. All right. Then we move to the period of the Tetrarchies. All this means is that when Herod the Great died in the year 4 BCE, he did not leave the kingdom to all one son. He had a few sons, and he divided it up into quarters. So we call that the Tetrarchies. Four parts. All right? And he turned those four parts over to his three sons. It's not an even, you know, it's not an equal number, but he gave one son two. Okay? So here's what we have here. So after he died, the big portion there, the lightest part, the bottom, Judea proper, he gives that to his one son, Archelaus. The two darker ones, he gave to his son, Herod Antipas, who I have over there. Okay? I'll talk about him more in a minute. And then up in the north, he gave that to his son, Herod Philip. Okay? The sons also took on the name Herod. So Herod Archelaus, Herod Philip, Herod Antipas. Okay? And that was that. Until the year 6 CE now. Okay? A few years later. One of the sons, the one who had Judea proper, Archelaus, he offended the Roman emperor. Well, I don't know if he offended him. I guess he was deemed incompetent by Augustus Caesar. This is in the time of Augustus, okay, the first actual Roman emperor. So he says, okay, this guy is incompetent, and he got rid of him. And instead of giving Judea to the other Herod brothers, he just decided to make it a Roman province. So in the year 6, that whole lightly shaded area, Judea with Jerusalem and the whole shot, that's, you know, the main area, that becomes a Roman province, meaning it's no longer a vassal state, but it's going to be ruled directly by the Romans with a Roman procurator in charge and Roman troops patrolling and so on and so forth. Okay? So direct Roman rule. The other two places, well, the three places, will not be made a province at this point. Okay? Pontius Pilate was the procurator of Judea, the governor there for the Romans, between the years 26 and 36 CE. Now that's significant because those are the years in somewhere in there where Jesus was active. Oh, and I probably should show you this. I don't know if you can see it very well, but right down here we have an inscription, part of one, and for a long time, we wondered, was Pontius Pilate a real guy? You know, well, we've got confirmation here. You can see on the second line, the last word there is Pilatus, P-I-L-A-T-U-S, Pilate, okay? But in Latin, of course. And then before it, you'll see the last couple letters of the name Pontius. Now, I wish I could remember exactly what this inscription was for, but it mentions his name and that he was procurator. So we do have some extra biblical evidence for the prefecture of Pontius Pilate. And by the way, he was known as being a very harsh ruler. He lived in Caesarea, which is on the coast. He did go to Jerusalem for the Passover each year to see what was going on, but he didn't usually stay around Jerusalem. And Roman soldiers were not stationed in Jerusalem permanently. Pontius Pilate, from what we can tell, relied on the high priest at Jerusalem to keep order. They were kind of buddy-buddy, Pontius Pilate and the high priest. All right, now, I got these other two maps here to also show you. It also shows you that no two map makers are alike, but you get the general idea of what we have in the area. Whenever I refer to things going on, I'll come back to the maps, okay? All right, but let me tell you about Herod Antipas. He is one of the brothers who had the two darker shaded areas to begin with, Galilee and Perea. Galilee is important because we believe that's where Jesus grew up. All right, so he would have been under the rule of Herod Antipas for actually, if not all of his life, most of his life. And there was relative peace during this period. Herod Antipas also would visit Jerusalem at the time of the Passover, but he didn't have any authority there, officially anyway. We know that he built a brand new city in Galilee called Tiberias. He named it after the Roman Emperor Tiberius, who was around at the time. He wanted to kind of impress him. So he founded a new capital there for himself called Tiberias. Unfortunately, it was discovered at the time that when he was building the city, he was building it on top of an old Jewish graveyard. And that caused a lot of upset among the people. And for a long time, no religious Jew would even set foot in that city because of the felt sacrilegious. Another thing about Herod Antipas that's interesting, he was first married to the daughter of an Arabian leader, but then he divorced her in order to marry this other woman. Her name is Herodias. It's like Herod, but I-A-S on the end. Herodias. And she was married to his brother Philip. But Philip was now gone. She was the ex-wife of Philip. And it wasn't actually unusual for a brother to marry the wife of his brother. Even by law, you're even allowed to marry your own niece at the time. But she happened to be his sister-in-law and his niece, which was unusual. And that also got people kind of, you know, were gossiping about that too. And I mention that because the Gospels tell us that he arrested a Jewish preacher named John the Baptist because John the Baptist criticized him for this marriage. And so he threw him into prison and later beheaded him. Okay, the marriage took place somewhere around the year 35 CE, for the best we can tell. All right. I should also mention that Herod Antipas did also take over the territory of Philip, so he will have all that area up in the north. Now, why this is important is because during Jesus' adult life, you've got one territory that's a client kingdom ruled by Herod Antipas, and then you have the other territory, which is a Roman province run by the procurator, Pontius Pilate, and during his life, Jesus goes back and forth between these two places. Okay, they're ruled differently. Now I want to tell you a little bit about some of the neighbors of the area. All right. First of all, the Samaritans. Who are the Samaritans? Well, the area of Samaria, if you look on the map, is just north of Judea. It's still in the province of Judea, but it's in the northern part. So it's between the central part of Judea and Galilee. What is interesting about it, though, is inhabited by people that the Judean Jews believed were not the same as them. Okay? They're not true Jews. All right? Look at this other map here. You can see Samaria again on this map there. See? All right? Back in ancient, even more ancient times, okay, earlier on, there were two Israelite kingdoms, a northern one and a southern one. The northern one was destroyed by the Assyrians before the southern one was destroyed. And supposedly, the Samaritans are descendants of those original people. The only problem is there were some deportations and there were people, foreigners, who were brought in and settled in that land and they mixed in with the indigenous people. And so the Samaritans of this time aren't, well, at least the Judean Jews accuse them of not being pure Jews. Okay. Plus, it wasn't just an ethnic thing. It was also a religious thing. All right. They didn't believe they worshipped the true God properly. Now, the Samaritans did believe in the Torah. They had a Torah, the first five books of the Bible. But they didn't worship at Jerusalem. They worshipped at their own mountain. Okay. And some of their religious customs were different. All right. So many Judean Jews looked down upon them as not worshiping God properly. They originally built a temple on the mountain that was in their territory, Mount Gerizim, which is not on the map, is it? Is it over on that map? No. All right. But anyway, it's in Samaria. But then it was destroyed during the Hasmonean period. But whatever the case, we have these Samaritans kind of smack dab in the middle of two significant Jewish populations. They'll be mentioned in the Gospels and also in the book of Acts, so I had to bring them up. Then we have some Arabian peoples. There were all kinds of tribal groups. And we're talking about northern Arabia here, not down, way down in southern Arabia. But there were these tribal groups around the territory that gradually began to be more and more powerful. Okay, and one of these groups is a people we call the Gileadites. And they took their name from the area that was called Gilead. And it's on the eastern side of the Jordan River. Okay, you don't actually see their name up here that I can see. But the region to the eastern side of the Jordan, okay, is often given the name Gilead. It was in the older times. We're talking about east of the Sea of Galilee, which is that, it's a big, basically a large lake up there, okay, the Sea of Galilee. There were all kinds of people that lived there. And the major cities, there were 10 major cities in that territory that we call the Decapolis, meaning 10 cities, okay? Well, you see the word Decapolis right there. You don't even see 10 cities, but there were 10 major cities there, okay? And that region is called the Decapolis. The people who live there are not Jewish, okay? They're what the Jews call Gentiles, which means non-Jews. But they're right next to all these territories we're talking about, so they're important as well. And the Decapolis is mentioned in the Gospels, okay? And then we have some more southern Arabians. Well, they're still northern Arabians, but south of the Decapolis. And that's Idumea and Nabatea, okay? I told you already about Idumea being where Herod the Great's father was from, and so he's part Idumean. The name comes from an older country named Edom, okay, which was always south of Judah. And these are supposedly the descendants of those people, although it's hard to really know for sure. Okay, they spoke Aramaic, and they were highly influenced by Jewish customs, because they're right next to them. Okay, plus they have some of their own customs. They did develop as a separate power base until they were incorporated into this province of Judea. The Nabataeans were not part of this territory. They're on the outside. But they were very, very militarily powerful. And they also made quite a bit of money through trade. That was their thing. Their most famous site today is the place called Petra. Have you ever heard of Petra? It's got beautiful artifacts and remains. You ever see Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade? You know, at the end, when they go in to find the Holy Grail, all right, that was actually filmed at Petra. But anyway, the Idumeans and Nabataeans and Gileadites at the Decapolis are not Jewish, but they are also important players on the political scene in this territory at the time of Jesus, so they should have been mentioned. Okay? All right. Now a little bit about the religious climate. As you might guess, the temple in Jerusalem was the most important center of worship, okay, and of corporate Jewish life. And I told you that Herod rebuilt the temple beginning in about 20 BCE, and he completed the major parts of it within the first few years, but they continued to add on to it for many years after that. Daily activities there at the temple drew a constant stream of visitors. Every year, people would come in from all over to check out the temple, especially during the time of the festivals, because that's when, you know, things were happening. The Torah admonishes all Jewish males to appear before the Lord at the temple three times a year. And so the big festivals were Passover, with the Greek term Pentecost. I'm going to use that one because that's what the Christians refer to it as. Pentecost in the summer. and the Feast of Tabernacles, or booths in the fall. Okay, there were three pilgrimage feasts. And that's when most people came. Passover, Pentecost, Tabernacles, using the Hellenistic terms. But they are mentioned in the stories of Jesus and also in the Acts of the Apostles, so I wanted to bring that up. All right? There were 24 divisions of the Jewish population, and each division was responsible for an entire week of temple activities on a rotating basis. Every Jewish lay or priestly family belonged to one of these 24 divisions, and it usually was determined genealogically. Of course, most of these divisions had enough priests in them that the priests kind of took care of most things, so I'm using anachronistic terms, but the lay people didn't always have to do a lot, okay, because the priests in their division usually took care of those things. But there were many Jews who made pilgrimages to Jerusalem at the time that their division was supposed to take care of activities, and, you know, say, I'm going to go this year, you know, and then they would go and help take care of things at the given time. Loyal adult male Jews from all over the world were in the habit of contributing one half a shekel every year to the temple treasury in Jerusalem. It was kind of like an ongoing donation. A shekel is obviously a monetary unit at the time. The executive supervisor of the temple was the high priest, and he actually directly participated only on special occasions. There were people under him that did most of the work, but he supervised everything. He had all kinds of assistants, and they policed the temple. They organized and assigned the weekly tasks to the priests. They administered the funds. All of these priests were what we call Sadducees, but I'll tell you about the Sadducees in a minute. They also were responsible for keeping law and order around Jerusalem. Well, actually around the temple mainly, but that was the center of Jerusalem. So they had their own troops, a little police force that was under the main control of the high priest. So the high priest had to know who was a threat and had to eliminate the threats before they got out of hand. The high priest during the time of Jesus was a fellow by the name of Joseph Caiaphas. His name is Caiaphas. Okay. He ruled for a very long time, 18 to 36 CE. And he is said to have been very harsh as well. And he and Pontius Pilate were in cahoots with one another, and both of them were removed from office in the year 36 because of excessive cruelty. For example, they killed a Samaritan prophet as well as 1,000 of his followers. Now, they claim they were doing it to keep law and order, but I think that was the straw that broke the camel's back, and they were removed. Okay. The socioeconomic impact of the temple was very considerable. There was all kinds of private economic activity in and around Jerusalem. You know, when these festivals are occurring, people from all over are coming. You know, this is when the vendors and everybody, they're making lots of money. Big times of the year. They had to house people, feed people, provide travel supplies. This is a big business. Another part of the business was providing animals for sacrifices. People would sell birds and various animals for them to use at the temple. All right, and money changing was a big part of the activity as well, which simply means, you know, you're exchanging currency so that you can use the currency that was used there. All right, I mention that because there's a story in the Gospels where Jesus has a little encounter with the money changers at the temple. And he doesn't take too kindly to them being there. But many Jerusalem residents made their living at the expense of these visitors, and sometimes they really would gouge them. All right. Any questions on that? All right, now, elders. The leaders of all kinds of organized Jewish communities, and it doesn't matter whether they're priests or not. Most of them, a lot of them weren't. Okay, but they were spoken of as being elders, mainly a mature man. And it doesn't necessarily mean that they had to be really old. even though they're called elders, they could have been younger, but mainly they were experienced, seasoned men. There's different organized groups that would meet together in the synagogue. We'll talk about the synagogues in a second, but there would be elders who were kind of like the empowered leaders of these various groups. Okay? And so these are like leadership positions. It's not just, oh, that guy's old, he's an elder. It's not like that. It's more like, oh, well, he's got a position here. We have to respect him. It's an actual kind of like an office. All right? How they were selected is kind of obscure, but we believe that each little body of elders that existed in each group were kind of self-perpetuating. They'd kind of choose their own guys to come and work with them and replace themselves and so on and so forth. These positions were apparently held for life. All right, now that leads into the synagogue. The temple wasn't the only place to worship, and it couldn't be because there were Jewish people all over the Mediterranean world, not just here. All right, they had been dispersed all over. There was a significant population of Jews in Egypt. Okay, there were some in Asia Minor. All right, in Greece, I mean, in Italy, everywhere there were Jews. Now, what, they're going to have to come to Jerusalem every time they want to worship God? No, they worship in their local communities. The word synagogue refers to a community organization. It actually, originally the word meant the group of people. It came later to refer to the building in which they met. Okay, but this early on, it usually refers to the actual congregation of people. Okay, but yes, there were buildings that they built to meet in, and those were often given the name synagogue too. And in isolated villages, they'd have them as well, and elders would preside over a synagogue. In cosmopolitan urban areas, these synagogues were much more important and kind of like the center of the Jewish community in that particular city. And there might be several of them. Even in Jerusalem, by the way, there were many synagogues. People didn't always go to the temple. Oftentimes, they would go to the synagogue to worship. Okay, we're told in later rabbinic tradition, and it's probably exaggerated, but we're told that there were 480 synagogues in Jerusalem in the first century. That might be an exaggeration, but that's what the legend is anyway. So different men presided in these synagogues than presided at the temple. So understand that. It's different, and many of them were not priests at all. Okay? But the regular Jewish person would go to both. You know, they'd go to the temple and the priest would do things for them there. They'd go to the synagogue and they'd learn from the leaders there. All right? They didn't really care. Scriptures. The Bible at this point is not yet what we would call a book, meaning like a book. People wrote on scrolls. And for the Jewish Bible, all the Hebrew scriptures, okay, you can't fit them all on a one big scroll. It's just too much, okay? So they were on separate scrolls. So it's kind of interesting the way, you know, we have to think of it now. When we talk about the Bible, okay, and I'm going to probably say the Bible from time to time, right? But I'm not referring to one big book or one big scroll. It's like it's a collection of scrolls. Remember, the Bible is an anthology. So it was compiled. And there would be collections of scrolls, sacred scrolls, that would be used like at the synagogues, for example. All right? But during this period, there still was not unified agreement among the Jews as to what scriptures belong in this sacred collection. There was an agreement that the Torah, definitely, the five books of Moses, right? They definitely are sacred scripture, and we follow the Torah. So that much was agreed upon. But there was an agreement about what else. From what we can tell, some groups used only the Torah. All right? Like the Samaritans. And apparently maybe even the Sadducees, the priests at the temple. But other groups, like especially ones like in the synagogues, they had other scrolls that they would use too that would be part of their sacred collection. Now, for Jews living outside of this territory, like those in Egypt, for example, or in other parts of the Mediterranean, they were using a translation of the Hebrew scriptures into another language, And what language would that be? Greek. Greek, yes. Which was the common language of the entire Eastern Mediterranean. Okay? Everybody knew Greek. And many people who were raised Jewish, they didn't even know Hebrew that well. Or at all. So oftentimes they would use the Greek translation of the Bible. Yeah, it's the first ever translation of the Hebrew Bible, the Hebrew Scriptures, into another language. It's translation into Greek. Okay, it was produced 3rd or 2nd century BCE in Egypt, and it came to be used very widely among Hellenistic Jews. That means Greek-speaking Jews throughout the Mediterranean. And I'm saying this because when the early Christian movement starts, many, many of these early followers of Jesus, they use the Greek Bible. And you'll see, like in their writings, they quote from the Greek translation, which is called, by the way, the Greek Septuagint. All right, abbreviated LXX, that's the Roman number 70. And it's from a legend about how the Greek Septuagint came about. But I'm not even going to get into that because we don't have time. All right? But if you see LXX, you know it's referring to the Greek Septuagint. And again, it's not a book. Okay, so even the Greek version of the Bible, all right, will be made up of many scrolls, and different people will use different scrolls depending on what ones they like better, you know. Okay, but the Torah is always in everybody's. During the last couple of centuries before Jesus, new writings were being produced in increasing numbers, and in several different languages among the Jews. And many of those writings actually claimed scriptural authority. You know, the author would be writing like, you got to believe this. This is from God, okay? So there were a lot of these writings that were being produced at this time. And they would usually be attributed to famous ancient figures like, you know, Abraham or Isaiah or Moses or Enoch or Daniel. People like that, okay? Clearly pseudonymous. Okay, and we call these works apocrypha or pseudepigrapha. They're kind of similar words. Apocrypha means hidden books. And the reason why we call them that is because these books claimed to have secret knowledge. And they explain like why no one ever, you know, they say, okay, this book was written by a famous figure from the ancient past, right? Well, how come we never heard of it before? It just kind of popped up now. Oh, well, it was hidden, see? It was hidden away, and no one knew about it, and it's only just been found, you know. That's what these books often claim to be. Hidden books that suddenly came out of the woodwork. And some people considered these books to be part of Jewish scripture, and others did not. Pseudepigrapha simply means writings under a pseudonym. I already told you kind of about this kind of literature last time, right? But it was common to use an authoritative name to kind of make it seem like it's more important. And we have a lot of this literature that was produced during this period. Okay? And again, it doesn't necessarily mean they were being dishonest. Maybe they were a little bit from our point of view. But when you think about it, look at Plato who wrote things about what Socrates said. And Socrates never said those things. But everybody knew that, you know. So this is just one of those genres that was big at the time. I don't know if you know this, but there are three main sections of the Jewish Bible. The Torah, which is the most important, which was probably formed first. And then you have the section called the Prophets, which by this time people were pretty much agreeing on, but there's still a little bit of difference of opinion. Some people didn't accept them. And then later, after this time, the third section called the Writings, that part will be formed. But that they're not even near there yet. And all these books I'm telling you about, they're kind of the ones that will gradually come into this third section, but many of them won't. Okay, so it's still in the process of formation. Now, the wisdom literature. Oh, we got to talk about that. Anyone know what wisdom literature is? It's literature designed to make you wise. Okay. But yeah, that's what it is, exactly. It goes back to the book of Proverbs, for example. Perfect example of wisdom literature. You open up Proverbs, you know, and it tells you all these little sayings about how to behave and do this and do that and live a good life. And, you know, Proverbs, that's a perfect example of wisdom literature. It was really big during this period. A famous work called The Wisdom of Ben Sirach came out at this time. It's kind of like a bunch of Proverbs. It came out about 2nd century BCE. And translating and writing in Greek required Jews to express themselves in new ways to accommodate aspects of Greek culture and philosophy. And you'll see it a lot in the wisdom literature. They're expressing their, you know, their traditional Jewish ideas, okay, and traditions, but they're expressing it in a way that their non-Jewish neighbors could really appreciate and understand. So they begin using language. Now, so what I'm saying here is many of these were actually written in Greek, okay? And they're written for an audience that, you know, is familiar with Greek ways. So a good example would be a text called The Wisdom of Solomon that came out around this time. And it dates to the period just before Jesus. And it says it's by Solomon, King Solomon, although obviously it probably is not, okay, because Solomon died 1,000 years before this, okay? But that's what it says. One of the key features of wisdom literature is the personification of wisdom. It was a device used in Greco-Roman works, too, where you take a quality or a concept and you'd personify it. So in The Wisdom of Solomon, you see that done with wisdom. Does anyone know what the word for wisdom is in Greek? Sophia. Sophia. So it's a lady. Okay? So when wisdom is personified, it's a feminine word. You know, there's gender in language, okay? It's a feminine word, so naturally she comes out as a lady. You even see her personified even earlier in Proverbs. Wisdom is personified. It says she was God's first creation, and she helped him create the world and things like that. It's actually in the book of Proverbs. And we believe that section of Proverbs is from, a little bit later than Solomon. But anyway, this Wisdom of Solomon, this other book, okay, which is even after that, has some interesting things. Now, let me read you a passage from it, and you can kind of see what they're doing here. Solomon says, "Therefore I prayed, and understanding was given me. I called on God, and the spirit of wisdom came to me. I preferred her to scepters and thrones, and I accounted wealth as nothing in comparison with her. Neither did I liken to her any priceless gem, because all gold is but a little sand in her sight, and silver will be accounted as clay before her. I loved her more than health and beauty, and I chose to have her rather than light, because her radiance never ceases. All good things came to me along with her, and her hands uncounted wealth. I rejoiced in them all because wisdom leads them." Sophia leads them. "But I did not know that she was their mother. I learned both what is secret and what is manifest. For wisdom, the fashioner of all things, taught me. There is in her a spirit that is intelligent, holy, unique, manifold, subtle, mobile, clear, unpolluted, distinct, invulnerable, loving the good, keen, irresistible, beneficent, humane, steadfast, sure, free from anxiety, all-powerful, overseeing all, and penetrating through all spirits that are intelligent, pure, and altogether subtle. For wisdom is more mobile than any motion. Because of her pureness, she pervades and penetrates all things. For she is a breath of the power of God and a pure emanation of the glory of the Almighty. Therefore, nothing defiled gains entrance into her, for she is a reflection of eternal light, a spotless mirror of the working of God, and an image of his goodness. Although she is but one, she can do all things, and while remaining in herself, she renews all things. In every generation, she passes into holy souls and makes them friends of God and prophets. For God loves nothing so much as the person who lives with wisdom." Now, this is like kind of, you know, nice when you use personification as a metaphorical device, but it almost is going a little bit further than that, because it's giving Sophia divine attributes, you know? And there are similarities in, like, what the Greeks were doing with, and we're going to talk about this later, but they were often personifying concepts and making them into gods. But you might say, well, wait a minute, this is Judaism, you know, they're monotheistic. How can they be creating a new kind of goddess or whatever? Well, they would say, no, we're not, you know. But It's a new way of kind of presenting their ideas to kind of make it palatable, okay, to a Hellenistic audience. So maybe some very pious Jews would find fault with a text like that, like, oh, this is being a little too, you know, polytheistic here, but others didn't have a problem with it. But anyway, in that book, wisdom is described as God's first act of creation, and then she helps him make everything else. And in fact, the Wisdom of Solomon says that in Genesis, when God says, let us make man in our image, that he is in fact talking to wisdom. So it's like, this is borderline polytheism here, but that's what they were doing. I bring this up because we're going to see some of this carry over into Christianity as well, and I wanted to show you kind of where it was coming from. Okay. New modes of piety and a heightened sense of observance. There were a lot of reforming tendencies in Judaism during this period, and a very heightened sense of personal piety. Like, a way of expressing this is through rituals, through holy days and things like that, but people were really trying, certain groups of Jews were really trying to be specially holy, more holy than everybody else, to show that they were closer to God and so on and so forth. And so you will find that some older practices will be reconfigured and rejuvenated and reinterpreted. For example, you know, the way you do Passover, the dietary laws, the way you observe the Sabbath. There were better ways of observing these things, and it made people feel closer to God by being more, you know, being more strict about it. Even new rituals and celebrations were developed during this time. Relatively late holy festivals were like Purim and Hanukkah, all right? These are not festivals that were celebrated in ancient Israel, okay? They developed during this period, or just before this period. So I just wanted to mention that, you know, people were feeling like, we got to be more holy, we got to be better, we got to please God better. There was a lot of that going on, so there were a lot of these reform groups that were really, you know, trying to be better than other people in regard to observances, okay? All right. Also, a characteristic of Judaism during this period, among some groups, is, and actually is kind of prevalent, but an idea that there's a sense of destiny about our people, like, and we're right on the cusp here. We're right on the edge of something great. We're living in a special time. Something big is going to happen. God is working through history, and we're at the culmination. We're almost at the climax of all of history. People had this idea, okay? And, of course, it goes along with the idea of chosenness or election that they already believed. A lot of it had to do with the fact that they were being ruled over by Romans, and they didn't like it. A lot of them didn't like it. Some didn't mind. Some didn't like it. But feeling like, we got to get our glory days back, you know, when we were independent, we had our own king from the line of David, so this idea of Messiah returning, and they're looking forward to that. So there were a lot of people who were really into it, and they believed that was within their own lifetimes, this was all going to happen, okay? Anyone know what an apocalypse is? It means, actually, you know, you see how it's similar to Apocrypha? It's because it also has to do with something hidden, but it means a revelation, something revealed. Okay, but in particular, apocalypses, these are new writings that are coming out during this period. Apocalypse is a prophecy designed to tell you what's going to happen at the end of the age or the end of the world. Okay, and it again claimed to be hidden secret knowledge that was revealed to someone specially. And they're known for being highly symbolic, working with numerology, and apocalypses were very much equated with eschatology, which is the teaching of the end of the world. Eschatology is about the end. Eschaton, it means the end of all things, right? So teaching about the end of the world, the end of the age. So if ever I refer to an apocalyptic eschatology, it means a book that's about the end of the age. It's presented as a hidden book with secret knowledge. That's an apocalypse, right? That makes sense? So there were works coming out like this. All right? People believed that the power of evil and the devil himself, by the way, in Judaism, during this period, there was more talk about a devil than there had been in earlier times. The devil is kind of a more recent development in Jewish thought. And the devil is in control of human history. And all of the governments, for example, are all owned by him. But very soon, God is going to step in and he's going to destroy the devil and all of his hosts, okay? And usher in a new period of peace, prosperity, and, you know, beauty, whatever, and everything's going to be great. All right? That's the message of all of these apocalypses. Every single one of them is about that. Okay? So these pieces of literature possess historical significance because they're written in response to existing conditions. These apocalypses will be about, like, what's going on in the world at the time. And, you know, it's usually a message of comfort. Oh, things are bad, aren't they? Look at what's going on, this and this and that and the other thing. Well, this is what's going to happen. God's going to change it all. It's going to be great. Okay? They're very dualistic. Forces of light versus forces of darkness. Good versus evil. Black, white, you know. Apocalypses are very much like that. And they're highly symbolic. So a lot of times, that's just kind of the genre, but sometimes we think that perhaps they were so symbolic because they didn't want, if the authorities found them, they didn't want to know exactly what they were talking about because it's often about the Roman Empire or something like that, and you don't want to be caught for treason. And hyperbole is also a major tool used in apocalyptic literature. Okay? All right. The Messiah. Can't talk about Christianity unless you first understand what a Messiah is. Okay, the word Messiah, based on the Hebrew word, which means an anointed one, someone chosen or anointed. Anointed means like you pour oil over someone's head. It's a way of showing that they're specially elected or chosen. So it's like a chosen one. But what a lot of people don't know is that the word was given to the King of Israel. The King of Israel was the anointed one of God. All right? Some priests were even called that. But generally, when we're talking about messianism, we're talking about the King of Israel. So the King of Israel is a Messiah. But then when there is no more King of Israel, they don't have one anymore, right? They're talking about, well, the king's going to come back. He's going to return. And, well, the king's coming back. They start referring to him as the Messiah. Okay? And then more and more, it's like a single individual. It's a person who's going to come back. He's going to restore the throne to Israel. Okay? So there's the Messiah. All right? But I just want you to know that it was originally a generic term that gradually began to be used to refer to one specific individual. So he's often associated with apocalyptic literature because it's all about the end of the age, the end of the world. Well, that's when the Messiah is going to come and he's going to do all this great stuff. He's going to free Israel from the yoke of the Romans and bring our kingdom back. It's going to be great. The Greek word for Messiah is Christ. All right? Christos in Greek. But it's the same word. The Hebrew word, the Greek word. So if you hear about Christ, it just means Messiah. So Christ is not like Jesus' last name. All right? Wait, I thought his name was Jesus H. Christ. No. No, it's not. Christ is just a title. And in the Greek translation, the Greek Septuagint, the Greek translation of the Hebrew Bible, you will find the word Christ there instead of Messiah, because it's in Greek. So when I talk about a lot of these Jews were using the Greek Bible, you know, it's very, oh, Christ. Christ is written about in the Old Testament or the Hebrew Bible, and that's why we call him that. That's how it works. But there were many people during this period who claimed to be the Messiah. Not just Jesus. There were other guys, too. Because it was kind of a big thing going on. Big, you know, popular sort of movement. All right, Son of Man. In the Hebrew Bible, the expression Son of Man can be used two ways. Well, actually, it's used mainly one way. It's only used one way. It's just an expression meaning a human being. Son of Man. It's just kind of that's the way Hebrew is. Now, when you translate it into Greek, they did it very literally in the Greek translation, and Son of Man. But there is one particular passage in the Hebrew Bible, in an apocalyptic work, as a matter of fact, the only apocalyptic work that's in the Hebrew Bible today, and that is the book of Daniel. And in that book, chapter 7, there's a prophecy, and it was considered by certain Jewish groups at this time a messianic prophecy. Okay, and it said that the Ancient of Days, God, is up on his throne in heaven, and he's got all these spirits around him, and he's got a big white beard or whatever, because he's very old. And he's sitting there, and he says, someone comes and approaches him, someone like a son of man. Now, the original author meant someone that looked like a human being was coming to approach him. And God gives this guy the kingdom. So they began viewing this as a messianic prophecy, some Jewish groups did. And then they started talking about the Son of Man, as in the Messiah. All right. So it becomes a synonymous term. So if you hear about the Son of Man, it's talking about the Messiah, just another term for that. Okay? All right. Another term, and a lot of people don't know this, okay, but the kings of Israel are sometimes called, the king would be called the Son of God. Okay, why? Because God is, you know, over all the kingdom, and he has placed a king on his throne. There's a lot of a language about, you know, this guy being like God's son. He's the heir to the throne. God has given him the throne. So the king is God's son. For example, in Psalms, Psalm 2, King David is called God's son. Okay? So the expression Son of God is another messianic phrase that certain Jewish groups use to just simply refer to the coming King of Israel, the Messiah. So all these terms, Messiah, Son of Man, Son of God, they're all basically equivalent. All right, we'll stop there. Next time I'm going to tell you about a very interesting group, the Essenes. We'll finish this up, and then we'll talk about the historical Jesus. So stay tuned.